So this is the introduction to class 4, and we'll do a quick review. You may recall that we started out things with Arjuna's shoka, his sorrow, his grief, because he is conflicted. He is in a bit of a pickle. There's a conflict between his own duty, Svadharma, as a warrior, which is to fight, which is to kill the enemy, and what's called Kula Dharma, which is the dharma or duty that one owes to one's family. So he doesn't know what to do. His enemies are his own family members, and he is stymied. So Krishna does not tell him, go back to your meditation room and, meditate and create some different karma so that you don't have a situation like this. He does not tell him that. He does not tell him to try to change the way things are, to try to change the reality or the situation that he's in for the better somehow. He says, accept the situation and fight. And that's what he says. And the whole text can be understood as an allegory. We have to fight the battle of life, have to fight in the battle of life. And we can't just turn our backs on unpleasant situations, run away, wish they were different, or to go into some fantasy about how it shouldn't be this way, it should be some other way. But to react wisely to the way reality is, and to deal with whatever wave comes your way. This is a metaphor I like to use. If you were there are these amusement parks, water parks that have wave machines, and the wave that they make is the same one over and over and over again, totally predictable. And, we may think that that's the goal of a spiritual life, is to create a situation where, everything that happens is predictable. And that's not either realistic or desirable. So, first of all, it's not realistic. There's never a wave machine of life. Like in the ocean, when you're out in the water surfing or body surfing or something like that, every wave is unique. Every wave has its own particular shape and duration and size and so forth. And you can't micromanage the ocean in order to get the same wave over and over again, or to get waves that you expect. It is unrealistic to think of trying to wire up life like that, first of all. Second of all, it's not interesting. It's not a desirable goal. It's not a realistic goal, so we don't have to worry about it. But, we sometimes think that we want things that actually aren't desirable at all. And the wave machine sort of idea of life is not a desirable goal. It's not even a good fantasy. It's just a fantasy and will always only be a fantasy. But, if somehow magically we got that, if somehow we got a life sort of wired up such that nothing unexpected would happen, we would be bored to death. There would be no joy of the surprises that we get in life. There would be no wonder, nothing that we already didn't know was going to happen would happen, nothing unpredictable. So it's not even an interesting goal to try to think about getting life under control like that, the wave machine approach to to life, and it's also not realistic. You're never going to get it anyway. So Krishna's not telling Arjuna, try to control the world. Try to fix the situation so you're no longer in the dilemma. He's not saying that. What he's saying is learn how to ride whatever wave comes along, whatever unexpected wave comes along, not how to fix the waves and regulate the waves and micromanage the waves so they're all predictable, but to learn how to surf under any conditions. So it's messy. Life is a messy thing. Life is not predictable. And so you know, the spiritual texts teach us, you know, generally speaking, not to fantasize about a different kind of a life, but to learn how to live in the messiness of this reality. And that's what Krishna tells him. You can think of the lack of acceptance of the way things are. It's like this now. The lack of acceptance in terms of the three, what they call poisons, or main mental afflictions. Desire, for example, raga, is discontentment of one sort. Discontentment with reality in one sort of modality. I want something I don't have. I want it to be better. I want more. And then aversion, the second of the three poisons, is not accepting what you do have. Pushing it away, wanting it to go away, wanting it to be different again. You know, this is Arjuna. This is what Arjuna is saying in the first chapter. I don't want it like this. I want to head to the hills. I want to relinquish my duty. I want to run away and renounce the world. Go live in a cabin or a cave in isolation somewhere where there isn't this messiness. And Krishna says, just forget about it, man. Forget about it. It's first of all not noble, he tells Krishna. He tells Arjuna. Krishna, this is his first kind of reaction to Arjuna's shoka, to his whining. Krishna says, yeah, you're supposed to be a warrior, you know. Don't wimp out. He appeals to Arjuna's sense of pride as a warrior. He calls him kind of a coward, and you know, that's pretty radical to tell a, you know, big time warrior, you know, you're just a big crybaby, you know. So desire and aversion, both attempts to neglect reality as it is and to hope for a reality different than the way it is. And then you've got the third mental affliction, which is ignorance. And one way of understanding ignorance, the third poison, is in relation to, you know, acceptance of the way things are. It's like this now. Ignorance is, it shouldn't be like this now. As if you were the sort of cosmic master of time and space and know what should be, how reality really should be. So each of the three main mental afflictions can be understood as attempts to turn our back on reality as it unfolds in our lives, in all its messiness, in all its unexpectedness, both for good and for bad. So in the first class, we talked about desire quite a bit, the problem of desire, and the problem is a huge problem, and it's recognized as the problem in both Hindu and Buddhist texts, and in yogic texts as well. It is obviously the opposite of peace. It is the opposite of contentment, of satisfaction, or nirvana, moksha, liberation, whatever you want to call it. It's obviously the opposite, to always be wanting more or something different, as opposed to acceptance of the way it is. So this is one of the first things that Krishna tells Arjuna is, you know, your problem is wanting things to be different, and they're not different. They're the way they are. And so he talks a little bit about the power of wisdom to free us from bondage. And one understanding of bondage is karma and klesha. Karma and klesha. Kleshas are the mental afflictions. And karma is the result of those mental afflictions, in terms of past causes, they cause us to be the way we are, and also the creation, fueled by the mental afflictions, of bondage to karma in the future. And this is the kind of sense that we have, that we always need to be fixing things, we always need to be improving things. And one text, the Ashtavakra Gita, the Danta text, defines samsara as the compulsion to do something all the time, to act. We feel compelled to do something because of past karma, what we call the vasanas, the proclivities or propensities that we carry around from past actions. And we constantly feel the need to fix things, to do things, to make them better. So karma is obviously, in this sense, bondage to the compulsion, to the feeling that we always have to be doing something about reality as it is. Then in the causal sense, you can say karma is caused or created, new karma for the future, by this, another sort of sense of compulsion, by purpose, by acting with purpose or intention. And many people have noted in the Indian texts, many texts have noted that intention is everything when it comes to karma. Whether it's good or bad, the relatively good karma comes from relatively altruistic intention. Relatively bad karma comes from relatively selfish intention. But karma, in all its forms, good or bad, is fueled by intention. So we will see that in the second, especially, set of teachings on the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna teaches Arjuna how to act without intention, without purpose, in order to act, to stay active, but not be in bondage to karma. So desire and ignorance, are two kinds of problems when it comes desire, ignorance, and aversion, the three kinds of problems. And in class two, we talked about another kind of aspect of the problem, and that's what ignorance really means. And ignorance means being taken in by the appearance of things. The way things appear and the way they actually are not the same. Things appear to have some kind of permanence to them, some kind of duration, and they do not. Everything is in constant flux. Things appear to have certain kinds of definitive essences to them, and they are empty of having any kind of essence like that. And those are the two out of the three, what they call lakshanas in Buddhism, marks, signs that distinguish reality. And the third lakshana is suffering. That comes from thinking that things that are impermanent are permanent, and thinking that things that do not have essences do have essences. So the third lakshana, the suffering, comes from mistaking reality for something else, thinking that reality is made up of permanent things, or thinking that reality is made up of things that are defined essentially. And by not recognizing reality as it is, then we suffer. So one other thing about for review, and then we'll start in class three. We called that class "Seeing the Unity Within Diversity." So another aspect of wisdom, as opposed to ignorance, is integrating with reality, samadhi or yoga, both of which can be understood as that, yoking or integrating with reality as it is, and it's all over the place. Such words are all over the place in the Bhagavad Gita. So what are you uniting with your yoga? What are you integrating with? And first of all, we are integrating with the world of appearances that has only a dreamlike existence, only a dreamlike reality. The purpose of a spiritual life is not to escape from the dreamlike quality of reality. It's not to substitute a better dream for the dream that we're living, but it is to be lucid in your dreaming. So it's not about waking up from the dream, which is the way things do exist in a dreamlike fashion. It's not to wake up from the dream, but to wake up in the dream, so that we are lucidly living in a world that only has a dreamlike existence, and therefore are not so affected by it. We're not so attached and fooled by the dreamlike quality of existence. And then a second understanding, maybe, of integration or yoking, is integrating into your true nature, integrating into who you really are, and stop identifying with the transient individual, and especially with the transient physical body. And this is very hard for us to grasp, even harder now than maybe before, because we are living in a day and age that's defined by materialism. Materialism comes in the form of consumerism, of shopping, of thinking that happiness lies in material goods. That's one aspect of materialism. And we're all susceptible to that. We live in a consumerist society. But materialism also has another sort of connotation, maybe even a deeper dimension to it, and that is the idea that the only things that exist are physical things. The only things that exist are things that we can measure or weigh or find out how wide or how many atoms it has or something like that, quantifiable reality. And the spiritual life is by definition opposed to that notion that the physical is or material is all that exists. That's what makes it spiritual, after all. There is a ghost in the machine. There is a spiritual quality to our being, and there's something spiritual about the world around us that cannot be captured in the laboratory and measured and put into some box. And so that's a sort of a deeper understanding of understanding the world as it truly is, a wisdom about the world, and a wisdom that entails understanding that not everything that exists can be measured. So let's move on, shall we? In class 4, called the Royal Secret.